baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile.
Interact right now. Text 960-960 to sound off. Sportsnet 960, the Fan.
With no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
802, as you're riding around in your automobile, we've got Chuck Berry as the artist of the day. The legend, the man, born in St. Louis, way back in 1926. Refined and developed R&B into the major elements that made rock and roll. Lyrics focusing on teen life and guitar solos and showmanship that became a major influence on what we now know as rock and roll. One of the legends, my friends. We'll be talking some Blue Jays baseball in mere moments as they are in Boston tonight. Fenway Park. It's a little unusual. This is not your older brother's Red Sox team. This is a team that all of a sudden is very young. All of a sudden selling parts, not adding them at the deadline. Jake Peavy is gone. And he's not going to be the only pitcher moved, as today's starter for the Bo Sox was supposed to be, I believe, a lefty that probably gets traded by tomorrow. For more on that, we go to color commentator on the Sportsnet Radio Network for Blue Jays broadcast, Joe Siddall. Joe, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, not a problem.
This is a bit of a fortunate break for the Blue Jays. Not often you go into Boston and catch them at sell mode the day before the deadline. Your alleged starter a few days ago is now scratched as he's expected to be moved in the next 48 hours.
No, the conversations around the Boston Red Sox this July are far different than most seasons, and to hear that Lester's been scratched from the start, that's a little break for the Blue Jays, and you know what, you don't want to take anybody too lightly in Brandon Workman, but I think any time you can dodge a John Lester, that's a nice break for the Jays.
Never mind dodging a lefty, because they've been really comfortable with the injuries they have right now, trotting out a ton of left-handed bats. They've got switch hitters through the lineup in terms of Cabrera, Reyes, and I believe Navarro, and then everyone else is a lefty except Bautista.
Well, they've had their troubles against left-handed pitching, and a lot of that is for that reason. And I think when you look at three key bats in the Jays' regular lineup, and Colby Rasmus, Adam Lind, and Juan Francisco, who made great contributions during that big winning streak earlier this season, left-handed pitching really neutralizes that. And we saw it out on the West Coast, Bob Belvin with the A's, but all kinds of lefties, he just kept parading them out of the bullpen. Then we saw it in Anaheim. They actually tweaked their rotation to get C.J. Wilson in there. So teams know, and that's those numbers don't lie, and the Jays have struggled, and that's part of the reason why that the Jays just acquired Danny Valencia to help out in that role, and Nolan Reimold was picked up for that reason as well. And I really liked what I saw from Reimold before he got hurt, and he's back now, and hopefully he's going to start playing regularly soon against left-handers, and hopefully those bats can only help out.
Now, I don't know a ton about your broadcasting history before joining the broadcast team, Joe, but I wonder what you knew about Marcus Stroman before this year and just how much he's blown the lid off the expectations that you may have had for him.
Yeah, no, I did not know him at all. I had no broadcasting experience, and being Canadian, I mean, I see the Jays a little bit, but I'm a Windsor boy, which is right on the border of Detroit, so I actually grew up a Tiger fan all my life. So a little removed from the whole Blue Jay scene, but I'll tell you what, as soon as I took this job and went down to spring training, I got to see Marcus Stroman firsthand with my own eyes, and that's how I like to evaluate rather than hearing what other people think. But boy, if I can, I don't know what to say. He has just been so impressive. I thought he was great all spring. But I think what really impresses me about him is that air of confidence that he pitches with. And he's just a great kid, real smart kid. He's a bright kid from Duke University, and he knows what he's got. He has very good stuff, and that's first and foremost, because I don't care how nice a kid is or how nice he is off the field, you got to have good stuff. And you know what? Stroman backs it up with great pitches, but he is pitching with some serious savvy right now, and he has a lot of confidence. He's attributing the game calling to Deonor Navarro. He says, I asked him the other day, he said, Deonor just puts the signs down and I throw it. So he's really allowing the catcher to guide him, but I'll tell you what, he'd be a lot of fun to catch because he's got four great pitches.
11 starts, 7 wins. Last night, 8 Ks, a single earned run at Fenway over 7 innings. I don't know what more you can ask out of a young kid. He took a no-hitter into the 7th in his prior start a week ago against the Red Sox. When does the conversation start about him being an ace? Is it too soon?
It's probably not too soon, but one thing I would guard against is he's a 23-year-old kid, and he is on an absolute roll right now. He's pitching just superbly. He's using all of his pitches. But again, I think that starts maybe after the season if he can continue to finish strong like this. And when I say he's a 23-year-old kid, what I mean is, hey, we do see young kids do this and they flourish and they do really well their first year up. But, you know, we'll see as the season progresses next year. Clearly, he's going to be a top of the rotation guy, I would think, to start next season. The way he's pitching right now, he's probably the Jays' number one pitcher right now.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, Mark Burley has not won since June 1st, and a lot of that has been run support. Some of it has been he hasn't been as sharp as he was for the first 2 months of the season, but there's no debate about it. Since Stroman has arrived, he's got to be their number one, right?
He is, and I think if you had to play a one-game playoff as a wild card right now, he's your guy to go to, and I think part of that, too, is because he's got the hot hand. I mean, he's had some struggles up here as well, but just lately he's been absolutely outstanding, and that's why I say I guard against it, because he is a 23-year-old kid, and next time out, he may go three innings and give up six earned runs. I don't see that happening the way he's throwing the ball, but we all know how this game works. It's a difficult game, and hitters around this league will begin to watch more and more video. There's a lot of advanced scouting, but bottom line is his stuff is electric right now, and as long as he can keep doing that, he's going to ride this wave and really help the Blue Jays down the stretch.
One more on Stroman before we move forward. A lot of talk before he arrived at the major league level about the plane of his fastball. Now, that kind of sounds like baseball nerdy talk, and it kind of is, but he's 5'9", and frankly, there just aren't a lot of pitchers under 6 feet, never mind under 5'10", in the majors, even if you look over the last 20 years.
Yeah, well, taller pitchers just generally have that leverage, and every pitching coach will talk about pitching downhill, and when you can pitch downhill, you're going to get more movement on your pitches. And for me, two key important concepts of pitching are location of the pitch and the movement of the pitch. And Marcus locates the ball pretty well. He's very good. He's got good command, and that's all part of your delivery and release point. I think that's great, but the way you get movement on the pitch is by getting on top of the baseball and getting good sink. He's got some pretty good run. He's thrown more two-seam fastballs lately. The two-seam fastball, you're going to get more downward movement and sink. When he's flat, and he can have a tendency to do that, is when he tries to overthrow a little bit, and that arm drops down a little bit, and now the ball stays on a more even plane. And when he does that, he can get hurt. And any pitcher will do that. Any pitcher in baseball that leaves the ball up over the plate a little bit against big league hitters. And we saw it last night. Pedroia got to him. He missed his spot trying to come in, and he just missed it out over the plate. That happens. But what he's been doing very well is he's not making those mistakes very often. And when you don't make too many mistakes throughout the course of a game, you're generally going to have success. When pitchers get in those ruts, and every pitcher goes through it, it's when your mechanics are coming out a little, you're coming out of your delivery a little bit, and things do flatten out. But size is an issue for him because he has to really make sure that his mechanics are very impeccable, that he's really repeating his delivery so that he can stay on top of the ball. But why, I tell you one thing, for me right now, it's that curveball that's just been outstanding for him. It's a real put-away pitch.
Jays have won 7 of 8. 9 of their last 11 will carry tonight's game in Boston, the finale of a 3-game set. They're looking for the sweep. First pitch, 5:10 Mountain Time. We'll join it in progress at 6 o'clock. And the guy you'll be hearing doing the color commentating is Joe Siddle. He joins us now on Sportsnet 960, The Fan. From the rookie to the veteran, Mark Burley throws today. Safe to say he's going to be looking to be better than his last start. He was roughed up on Friday in the Bronx.
Yeah, he's had a bit of a rough go, and not just that start. I think his last few starts, I've been seeing a little bit of a different Mark Burley. His pitch count's been getting up a bit. And for me, it's his command. His command has been impeccable. That's why he was so darn good that first half of the season. This is not a guy that's going to wow you with the radar gun. His fastball is going to top out around 83, 84. So he really lives on a couple of those things I talked about, location and movement. And really, when he's very good, he's got all of his four pitches. He's locating them well, and he's getting good movement. I remember talking to Deonno Navarro earlier in the season, and you know, we almost kind of chuckled about it because here's a guy just carving up major league hitters, throwing 82 and 83 at times. But he looked at me and he said, everything moves, and he locates the ball so well. And I mean, as a catcher, those are two key components, and Burley's just not getting that as much right now. His command is a little off. I spoke with Pete Walker about that just yesterday, and he says, you know, you just keep working. It's one of those things. Sometimes pitchers go through ruts where they just lose that feel, and they're not locating the ball as well. They're not getting the movement. One thing he did mention, I think we're going to see more curveballs out of Mark Burley tonight. When he's very successful, he's spinning that slow curveball in there to right and left-handed hitters, and that way it's allowing that changeup and cutter that he throws to both sides of the plate to work more effectively.
Interesting. Quick note, trade deadline, 2 days, the 31st. It's not the end of all movement. This is, I believe, the non-waiver deadline. All the moves after July 31st, guys will be placed on recallable waivers, and there's still some movement to be made. What are your expectations for the Blue Jays prior to August 1st, and then beyond once we get into the waiver phase of the trade season?
Well, whatever does not happen between now and tomorrow can still happen in August. So that's good news. And I think what that does, you may see, I talk a lot of GMs around the league are talking this year, you may see more of that happening in August because there's so many teams that are just on the fence there. Are we in this thing or are we not? You look at the Tampa Bay Rays, they were totally out of it a few weeks ago. They've gone on this wonderful run, and now all of a sudden, instead of them talking about getting rid of David Price, they're talking maybe of adding a piece. They're doing what they need to do to make this run. So I see the Jays acquiring Valencia was very minor. I think it's just helping the short term against the left-handed pitching like we talked about. Now, I still think they could use an arm in that bullpen. The bullpen, the pitching in general has been decent, but I think decent at best. And, you know, when that lineup went cold there for a while, things were really bad because you can pitch as good as you want, but when the lineup dries up, you still have to score runs. But I think that lineup is rebounding. I don't think the lineup is an issue for this team, especially getting Lurie and Landon Encarnacion back in the next few weeks. But I can see a bullpen arm of some sort. I personally was looking at Joaquin Soria from Texas. I thought he would have been a great pickup, but he went to the Tigers just to shore up that bullpen. I think Aaron Sanchez, just the call-up of Sanchez, is like acquiring a right-handed big leaguer because I think he's going to really help down there. But bottom line is I would really love to see a starting pitcher. And, I mean, of course, you hear Lester, you hear Price. Those are front-line guys. I'd love to see a starting pitcher, but I also would not give up a Stroman or Sanchez to get it. You may have to give up some second-tier prospects for maybe a solid veteran big league starter. You've heard the names Ian Kennedy, heard the names Bartolo Colon, John Lackey's another one. Just a veteran-type guy that's been around that can really help this rotation. If they do make the playoffs, you know, Hutchinson, I think we can almost count out pretty soon because he's getting up there in innings. You can count on Stroman as the kid, and hopefully he continues to be this little wonder boy. But Burley and Dickey's been good, and he's going to have to be real good, and Mark's going to have turn it around for them to have a chance if they do make the playoffs.
It's an interesting point, and by adding a starter, you really are adding a reliever by default because you're going to have to move someone from that rotation back into the pen. And then on top of that, you've got Daniel Norris knocking on the door. He's done pretty well in Double-A since his promotion, a 6'8", I believe, left-hander, a towering lefty. I don't think anyone would be shocked if he surfaced in September.
Well, I don't think I'd be shocked either. In fact, if they do not go out and get a veteran type like a Soria, like I talked about, or a Joaquin Benoit for the Padres, those types of names, like a good veteran arm to have down there to solidify that bullpen, if they don't go out and get one of those guys, then maybe your next best thing is just bring up Norris. Why not? They did it with Sanchez. You brought him up. He certainly looks like he belongs. And, of course, you can always have those first-year jitterbugs from kids, but you know what? There's one way to find out about these kids. Bring them up and throw them into the fire. Sanchez has certainly responded. Maybe Norris can do the same, but I just think the rotation is a key because Hutchinson is going to be on limited innings. I know they've got to really watch him, and to me, he's been a concern all year because of the Tommy John surgery and only throwing 35 innings last year. So to me, even if the Jays do make a run here in September, I don't think that Drew Hutchinson's going to be a very big part of it. He's going to either have to go to the bullpen or be shut down totally. And you know what? The Washington Nationals did it with Steven Strasburg, not to equate the two, but it happens. You have to protect that arm, and I think the Jays, if they're going to make the playoffs and make a run here, once you get to the playoffs, you need starting pitching. If you're going to go up against the A's or the Tigers or the Mariners, you need some horses, and I think the Jays could really use somebody at that front end of the rotation to solidify things.
What would you think about maybe trying to give Hutchinson as much time off between starts as possible? One of the things I look at a ton is how a guy does on regular rest versus extra rest. I know there's home and away splits, but I think that's more just chance and luck than anything else, or just, you know, things falling where they may. Whereas an extra day of rest is something tangible to the body. His velocity is about 2-3 kilometers an hour or miles an hour faster on his fastball on extra rest than it is on your standard 4 days of rest. What do you make of that, and is there a way to exploit that so that he can help you down the stretch?
Well, I think John Gibbons has talked about that throughout the season, and they've done that on occasion where they've had mixed days off or they've added somebody in to give each starter a day off. And when he did that, he was talking mainly about Hutchinson to protect him because of the innings and the surgery and not pitching a lot last year. And he also talked about, with R.A. Dickey and Mark Burley, just being older guys, and when they could get an extra day, that's a great thing. But I don't think it's necessarily going to work for the long term, like through the end of September and into October, because I think it's just the actual volume, the number of innings that Hutchinson is going to log. And I think, again, coming off throwing only 35 innings last year, you have to be very careful. So an extra day off here or there is great for Hutchinson, but the bottom line is if you're still going to start him, he's still going to accumulate innings where you're starting to get into, quote, maybe danger zone. So I think that's where they're going to have to really protect him. And that's why bringing in another arm makes total sense, because then you can throw him in that bullpen, kind of like Sanchez. They're doing that with Aaron Sanchez right now. By bringing him up and putting him in the bullpen, they're also keeping his innings down. If he came up as a starter, he'd probably be done real soon here. So that way they can throw him for an inning or two innings on occasion and maybe stretch him out so that he can last the entire season.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, Sanchez probably has two starts under his belt if he's a starter, and that's a lot of innings versus the four and a third, which he's pitched out of the bullpen since he's been called up. Very quickly, just to the injury update, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like Laurie will be last. Encarnacion had a bit of a setback, but Adam Lind is closest. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say, and that's what we're getting when we hear, when we talk to John Gibbons each day. And to be honest with you, I think it's just wearing Gibby out. I mean, it's very difficult as a manager. I know Jim Leland was great for this with the Tigers for all those years. He just said, you know what, tell me when my guys are ready when they come here. I got 25 to worry about right here. So it's very frustrating. And, you know, these injuries, just when you think, Edwin, we had heard that he was coming along and might be back pretty soon, all of a sudden he has that setback. So who knows how that goes, but the order you just gave right there, I think you're right on. But bottom line is, who knows? It could be a week, it could be a few weeks. But, you know, bottom line, when you get those players back, this team's going to improve greatly. And quite frankly, that's going to be like a blockbuster trade in itself, adding those three bats to his lineup.
Yeah, no question. They've got Navarro hitting four behind Bautista. I mean, just think about how much better they'd be with Edwin in there, never mind Laurie in the bottom of the lineup instead of one of those platooning guys they've got at second and third. It's going to be fun to watch down the stretch. They've got a four-game set in Houston before the biggest series of the season to this date. Would that be fair to say when they come home and play three against Baltimore next week?
Well, I think you're right on with that, because what they've done, too, is their struggles there before the All-Star break. You know, they were in a pretty bad downward spiral there, and it looked like the season was getting away from them. But the All-Star break couldn't have come soon enough for this group, and I think everybody came back refreshed and recharged. And what they've really done is they've beat up some weak teams, you know, coming out of the break there with Texas and then Boston. Not that the Yankees are a weak team. It's a place they don't win very often, but they did a good job in New York City. And then they get the Red Sox here. Now they're going to Houston. So I think it's going to be a very pivotal series against the Orioles, because it's a top team. That's the team you're chasing. And it's going to be the first probably real big test besides Yankee Stadium that they've had since that West Coast trip. And you know what? They've been getting tremendous contributions from throughout the lineup. A lot of the AAA kids that have come up are contributing right now. Ryan Goins is really doing a nice job. Anthony Ghost with that huge hit last night. So you need that. And when that offense was drying up, those guys weren't doing much, but either were the big boys. And it looks like the big boys are starting to step up a little bit now. Melky Cabrera's just been outstanding. And as you said, Deonna Navarro's had some big hits. Bautista is Bautista. Reyes is a catalyst at the top of the lineup. But, you know, lineups do that. That's what hitting, that's what baseball seasons do. There's lots of ups and downs. And unfortunately, they went through a stretch there where they just weren't hitting. But it looks like that offense is kicking in again. I think that Baltimore series is going to be huge.
Yeah, we can't wait. Much like tonight's game, we'll join it in progress at 6 o'clock Mountain Time. We look forward to yourself, Jerry, and Mike, and the great job you guys do on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Joe, an absolute pleasure. Not only you joining us today, but having to listen to you in year one has been very nice. Keep up the good work.
Much appreciated. Thanks very much.
All right, that is Joe Siddall of the Blue Jays broadcast on Sportsnet. Again, it is the third of three in Boston tonight. Joined in progress at 6 o'clock following the big show. We'll come back with some Calgary Flames trivia from 04. It is a hump day edition of Stump the Hump as we put Josh Humphreys to the test with his intimate knowledge of the 2004 Stanley Cup runner-up Calgary Flames. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well.
Flames, Stamps, NFL, MLB, Calgary's only all-sports radio, Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
Young Monsieur and Madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, c'est the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
8:25 on your Wednesday. Nice to check in with Joe Siddall, the color guy of the Blue Jays. Haven't had him on in the mornings, but he mentioned it. He's a Windsor guy. It's his first year as a broadcaster. He's doing a great job. Really like the dynamic he's got with Jerry and Mike. We'll have that game at 6 o'clock. Joined in progress as the Jays. They won 8 of 9 and 9 of 11. And a sweep not out of the realm of possibility at all, as they were supposed to go up against lefty John Lester, right? Lester was supposed to go. I always confuse Lester and Lackey. This is my issue. I'm going to acknowledge it right now.
Lester's supposed to go, yeah.
I completely confuse the two. I always confuse them. Lester's the lefty. Lackey a righty. So they were supposed to get Lester. He's going to get traded. They are scratching him. And Brandon Workman was recalled from AAA Pawtucket. He'll throw today. He's a righty as well. That's a better matchup for the Jays lineup, at least now in their current formation. Yesterday, a ton of lefties, and they did well. Looking for the sweep against the Bo Sox. From the text line, let's not get too excited and jump all over the Stroman bandwagon just yet. Yes, he's pitching pretty unreal right now, and I love the guy as a Jay, but look what happened to Romero when Jays fans got all excited about his unreal season. I don't know what kind of a cautionary tale Ricky Romero is. I mean, he was their ace. He had a great year.
Pretty unique situation.
But he lost it all. He lost it. And I think more of it is between the ears than anything else. It's not like he lost velocity on his fastball or he couldn't throw a curve anymore. He just couldn't locate his pitches. So I don't know that Ricky Romero is a good analogy for Stroman versus any other pitcher ever in the majors. You know what I mean? I mean, one's a short righty. The other's not that tiny. He's a lefty. And Romero really, really had a tough time getting lefties out. Stroman doesn't have those exaggerated splits against one side or the other. So I see what you're saying. But again, all we've seen is 11 major league games as a starter. There's not a lot to dislike about what we've seen. So while I understand you're trying to temper expectations a little with that text, he has been their best pitcher. And if they get into the postseason, it will be on the back of a lot of fantastic starts of Marcus Stroman. He's been their guy since he started as a starter. Nice using the same word twice in the same sentence. Started as a starter. He's been awesome. He's been dominant since they moved him from the bullpen. There's no question about it. And you can go ahead and, you know, spray cold water all over this thing. I'm more than happy to clear off every fifth day to watch Marcus Stroman pitch. He's been that electric. It's the Stro Show. I text buddies. Hey, Stro Show. 5:10 first pitch. Are we going for a beer? I mean, he's that good. He is now the guy I want to watch. If we're going to get together, have a pop, a few of the boys, it's a Stroman start. Burley start's not a bad one because he moves quickly. But Stroman's stuff is just absolutely electric. Elsewhere, Joe Settle doing a great job as a color guy. That text coming in about 10 minutes ago. Very good. And elsewhere, what do you think about the Cardinals' Patrick Peterson's new deal that makes him the highest paid cornerback ever in the NFL? Do you think he's worth it? Well, I saw that money and I was like, ooh, that's more than Richard Sherman's making.
Huge money.
Big dough. He's good. One common thread with all the signings of the NFL this offseason, guys are getting paid.
Yeah.
And I believe that their cap is set to jump in the NFL. Not this year, but either next year or the year after. So that is taken in consideration when agents are negotiating 4-, 5-, 6-year deals. They know the cap's going up. So, yes, they're going to ask for a lot more dough than we've seen in years past. Hey, guys, come on. It's only 11 games. Hello, McGowan, Romero. Give it up, losers. The Jays prospects always crap the bed. That's from Jer. Now, Jer, I don't know if you're a not smart human or if you enjoy hating on the Blue Jays. I don't know what Marcus Stroman, a human, has anything to do with Dustin McGowan or Ricky Romero more than he has anything to do with Adam Wainwright, David Price. Because he wears the same laundry every fifth day when he pitches, he's cursed as a prospect? There's no data there that makes any sense. I understand you can feel that way, just don't think it's educated. Also from the text line, more Patrick Peterson conversation on his extension with the Cardinals. He's better than Sherman, period. Well, I don't know. Sherman seems to be that shutdown corner these days, and Patterson isn't bad, or Peterson, I should say, isn't bad. But I would still take Sherman over him, but it's not by a huge margin. He is a very good player, no question. We'll get more into the NFL later on. What you want to talk about is about an hour away. Still to come, James Myrtle out of Toronto for the Globe and Mail at 9 o'clock. We'll talk Jake Gardner contract. We'll talk the youngest assistant general manager in the NHL, 28-year-old Kyle Dubas being signed. And what did Mason Raymond look like last year in Toronto? Sure, you can look at the numbers, but what can we expect as people in Calgary watching him suit up with the Flames this year and next year and a third year, that $9 million contract that he signed on July 1st, I believe. So James Myrtle at 9. Also, we'll talk Program of Excellence. Hockey Canada's Ryan Jankowski, their head scout, will be on in about 10 minutes' time. But right now, we probably need some game show music because it is time for Stump the Hump with Josh Humphreys. Now, Josh, what was the trivia question Monday? Do you remember?
Yep. Who were the four Flames that made over $2.5 or $2 million, whatever it was?
That's right. So on Monday, it is all 04 Flames trivia because that is Hump's area of expertise. Which four players made over $2 million? You nailed it. Jerome McGinley, the no-brainer. Roman Turek, a lot of guys forgot about because he was the backup once they got Kipper.
Yeah.
And he was injured a lot of the season, which is why they went out and got Kipper. The other two were not too difficult. Jelena
and
Conroy. So you did well. You nailed all four. A little harder today.
Uh-oh.
I'm not going to be drastically difficult, but I still have faith you can get this done.
Okay.
In the playoffs in 03-04, the Calgary Flames dressed 9 defensemen.
Okay.
6 of them played 20-plus games in the playoffs. Now, they played 26 games because they went 7 games, 6 games, 6 games, 7 games, right? Mm-hmm. 26 games in total in the playoffs. So 6 guys played most of the games, 20. 2 guys played 6 games apiece, Tony Lidman and Denny Gauthier.
Yep.
And Brendan Evans played 2 games as well. Dion Phaneuf did not play. There was talk that maybe they could sign him and get him in there, but that would be a lot to ask for a kid out of Red Deer. So I want you to name the 6 defensemen that played 20-plus games for the Flames in the 2004 playoffs in which the Flames went to the Stanley Cup Final.
Rhett
Warner. That is correct.
Steve Montador.
Mike Commodore, that is correct. That's 3.
Jordan Leopold.
All 26 games for Jordan Leopold. Robin Regier played all 26. That is correct. I thought Regier didn't play all 26, but he just was playing banged up the whole time. Because I remember him being so injured, so when I talk about 04, I'm like, geez, would have been nice if Regier could have played more. Well, he played all the games. He was gimping around the ice the whole time.
Leopold, Regier, Warner, Montador, Commodore, and...
Missing one. You've done pretty well. You've ripped the 5 off in a hurry.
Oh, boy.
Text line, who are we missing? Josh, get off the computer.
I'm not on the
the mouse.
I'm not looking.
Get off your phone. Now you pick up your phone. Come on.
Who is it going to be?
What are you doing? Checking emails? We're doing the middle of trivia here. This is Stump the Hump.
One more, hey. Who was it?
Okay, so
Evans 2, Lidman and Gauthier. Gauthier got hurt, Lidman out.
You've got Leopold and Regier. They each played 26 games. Our very own Rhett Warner typified what it is to be a playoff warrior. He played 24 games. That's a good word, yeah? And Montador and Commodore each played 20 games apiece.
One more.
One other guy played more than 20 games for the Calgary Flames. In fact, he played all 26.
Yes. Who am I missing?
Now we mentioned Tony Lidman played 6, Denny Gauthier played 6, and Brendan Evans got in for a pair.
Yeah, Gauthier got hurt in round 1. Who?
Text line is all over it, by the way. You're going to be very ashamed of yourself.
I'm ashamed of myself because I cannot think of it. You got to give me one hint about it.
He's still in the league.
Still in the league. What? Who am I forgetting?
Oh, Josh. It started so well on Monday. You sounded so
well
smart.
Today,
and you ripped off 5 of the 6, and you've got the mental block.
One more small hint.
He subscribed to Adbusters magazine, which is a very non-traditional left-leaning. He's got some different philosophies on the world. Maybe how one should live on this planet. Pretty unusual cat. Might even ride his bike places. rather than using
Andrew
car.
Ference.
Oh,
so how did I not get that?
Andrew Ference.
How did I not remember Andrew Ference?
Oh, wow.
There it was. Andrew Ference. I would have got that eventually. It took a while, but I got it.
Well, you know what? It is 8:35, and the show does end at 10, so we had to give you some clues. Plays in the bloody province, Josh. Now, you got him, but...
I got him without any help.
Part marks.
Any help, I mean, got it.
5.5 out of 6. But again...
I still got it.
Pretty
eventually.
Solid. Yeah, well, after I told you who he was, practically. Come on.
Well, how am I supposed to know what magazine he subscribes to? That's not a hint.
Well, okay, so when I told you he rode his bike to the rink, that gave it up, did it not?
How would I know he rides his bike to the rink?
You didn't know Ference rides his bicycle to the rink? He did it in Boston all the time. He got half the team riding to the rink on the bike.
I did not know that.
From the text line, Andrew Ference, Andrew Ference, Andrew Ference, 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 Ference. Too easy, Pinder, too easy. Ference, 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 Ference. There you go. So, now, here's the thing. The difficulty in the trivia isn't necessarily remembering Andrew Ference. It's that you have to wrap your head around that decor and remember all these guys. It's not necessarily to put yourself back in 04 and remember those pairings. And you're going to forget one guy. It's not easy to remember six guys off a roster 10 years ago. So you did well. We'll give you the pass. When we come back, we will be chatting some Hockey Canada with Ryan Jankowski, the head scout of Hockey Canada, the program of excellence, changing how they operate with younger players. I don't know if this is a big deal or what I'm supposed to make of it, but it's going to be more centralized through Hockey Canada, and there's going to be a ton of our country's best players under the age of 17 in Calgary coming up. So we'll talk about that in mere moments with the head scout of Hockey Canada. Later this morning, it is James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail talking all things Gardner contract, all things expectations for Mason Raymond, and this 28-year-old advanced stats phenom, who is now the assistant general manager of Brendan Shanahan's Toronto Maple Leafs. This is not Dave Nonis' squad anymore, my friends. It's been made very clear whose philosophy, who's got the final say, and who the big dog in Toronto is. It is Sportsnet 960, the Fan.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it.
Talking hockey right now. Sportsnet 960, the Fan.
If you wanna dance with me. If you wanna dance with me. I have no kick against my...
8:42 on your Wednesday morning. Hockey Canada is making some changes to their national under 17 program. In fact, it's becoming national. Not sure what to make of it, and so we welcome on the Subway Restaurant's Fresh Take Hotline Ryan Jankowski, the head scout of Hockey Canada. Morning, Ryan.
Morning, guys. How are you doing, Ryan?
I am very well. Good to hear your voice. It was nice to connect with you at the coaching conference out in Vancouver a couple weekends ago, and you had brought up in your presentation that you'd made to the 100-plus coaches in attendance that the under-17 program is changing for Hockey Canada. Maybe you can start us out with how traditionally it had worked and what's exactly changing nationally.
Well, typically we've had five regional teams representing Canada at the under-17 World Hockey Challenge, which was at Christmas time for about the past 15 to 20 years. And as the process has gone on, that was all left up to our provincial branches. They did an excellent job of putting the best players on the ice and representing the five regions of Canada, which were Pacific, Alberta and BC West, which was Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Quebec, and then the Atlantic provinces. As Hockey Canada reviewed everything and looked at making the program better, led by Scott Salmond, who is the vice president, they felt that at this level we could do a lot more with our players. We could bring the players into one neutral location, one site, bring in the best players in the country, and now have them participate as Team Canada. And I think the advantages to that are there's many of them. We get to introduce them into the Hockey Canada way sooner. The branches did a very good job of that, but you didn't have the best players in the country because with five regional teams, you may have the third best goaltender in Canada, but he's also the third best goaltender in Ontario, and he wouldn't be able to play for that team. So now we are truly high performance with this. We've got 108 players in here this week, practicing, developing, playing some games, which is an evaluation for myself, but more so development for these players. And coming into one site for all of Canada breaks down some boundaries for these players. So the kid from Ontario, who's an elite player, also sees the elite players from Western Canada, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada, which we think is going to push them to be better. And by the time these players go through the under-18 program and the under-20 program, when they get to their 19-year-old year at the World Juniors, they'll be have been through the program three or four times as opposed to one or two.
So there are quite a few advantages. I like the example you gave. If you've got the three best goaltenders in the country all in the same branch, only two of them are going to represent that branch at the U-17s. Now under this new format, you can bring them all into this camp. For example, I think you've got the breakdown here on the website, 32 from Ontario's Hockey Federation, another four from Eastern Ontario, 24 from Quebec, and then 13 from Alberta. So the stronger provinces get all their best players there rather than just the best in the region.
Without a doubt. And then as we move forward with this process, instead of having the five regional teams performing at the event, we're going to go down to three national teams. And with those 66 players, we have the best 66 players in the country, and there's no regional bias to that. So we look at the 108 here, we evaluate them here, have them develop here. They go back to their seasons, whether playing Junior A or in the CHL or midget. And then once we're ready to pick our rosters, we pick the best 66 players in the country, and that for us is truly high performance. And then mixing those players up so that there's no regional bias. It's not just Western players, Ontario players, and Eastern players playing together. Everybody gets a chance to play with everyone and break down that comfort zone at an earlier level.
Yeah, so for example, as you said, if the best three goalies are all from Ontario, just throwing it out there, if that's the situation, each of those three teams at the Christmas time tournament could have an Ontario goalie rather than one of those guys being left at home. Now, what about the format of the tournament, because traditionally, as you mentioned, there's been the five Canadian teams. How does this tournament look now with foreign nations and the three Canadian teams?
Yeah, we're going to go to an eight-team tournament now. So instead of 10, we're knocking out the two Canadian teams. We're going to an eight-team tournament, three Canadian teams, five international teams, and it's a great opportunity for our guys to play international competition. We're also moving the timing of the tournament from Christmas, which always coincided with World Juniors, but given with what World Juniors is now, and this is such a great event because really one of the few times across the board that we are able to have best-on-best competition. With the under-20s, you have the NHL influence. With both our under-18 teams, CHL playoffs and junior hockey playoffs get in the way of that at the World Championships, but the under-17 has always been a real strong event, so from a Hockey Canada standpoint, they get a chance to market the event a little bit more when it is in November, the first week of November this year in Sarnia, Ontario. And then with it being the three Canadian national teams, we hope that those, because they are national teams, will have a stronger output at that event against the international competition.
And you mentioned that best on best is key. So all of the top players from all these countries will be at the event. You'll have three Canadian teams, obviously of the Americans and some notable European sides. You mentioned that U18s get thrown off by CHL playoffs. There's NHL influences on U20. And am I correct in suggesting that some nations use the Hlinka tournament for certain players, not necessarily their best players?
That's often the case. Normally we find that the European teams more often than not send their best teams. The only team that traditionally is not the strongest team is the U.S. The U.S. does not send their national development program team. They send the next group of players who went through tryouts this summer. But for us in Canada, that's a great event for us. We've had a lot of success at it. Our camp starts coming up for that this weekend, so we're going to have a Winsport here. The under-17 camp going on. We're going to have the under-18 camp, and with the 108 for the under-17s and the top 44 with the under-18s, there's going to be some real good hockey players here in the 97 and 98 age groups.
So when does that run, and how do you separate the two, or is it all together in terms of you might have back-to-back ice times with the U-18s and U-17s in the same building?
Well, that's exactly what we've got going on. So we'll have games starting tomorrow night with the under-17s. So the under-17 games run the 31st of July, the 1st of August, the 3rd and 4th of August. And then the under-18s have their inter-squad games on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of August. So you know, literally we'll have two rinks going here. There'll be an under 18 game in the big rink and maybe an under 17 game going in rink B. So there's a lot of action going on around here, and it's a real fun time for us.
One of the things that it always is tough for Canada as a nation in hockey, and there's not many hurdles because of the fantastic work that is done by Hockey Canada, because of the enthusiasm for the sport, but one of the things we can't really compete with seems to be the chemistry that these smaller nations have. They've got their best athletes together at a younger age. They're smaller nations. Geographically, it's a lot easier to collect people in one place. Does this, with the U-17 now becoming national, allow for maybe a little more chemistry in these single elimination short tournaments? By the time you get to U-20, you might be familiar with a teammate back to a U-17 event, rather than under the current structure, the previous structure, I should say, guys maybe hadn't played together before they got to that tournament.
I think there's a reasonable, you know, a feeling for that with the chemistry. I think you can build some of that, but more so it's to get our message across and the consistent message that we want to drive throughout our programs, a particular style of play, and really what we're talking about this week, and with all three of our camps going on, and our World Junior Camp starts next week in Montreal, is the Canadian way, and that's going to be a theme amongst all our programs. And it's not as much the chemistry amongst players, but just to get the players to buy in on the way that we do things, the way that, you know, our Olympic teams have performed, especially this past year with the success that we had in Sochi with both our men's and women's teams. Some of the characteristics of those teams and what it takes to win when you're a Canadian team. We'll always be at a disadvantage with some of the other nations from a chemistry standpoint. They get the opportunity to be together as teams much more frequent than we are. So we have to try and keep up and lead the way from what we can do in Canada, and that's a huge reason why we've changed the under 17 program.
We're chatting with the head scout of Hockey Canada, Ryan Jankowski, about a change to the U-17 format nationally. You mentioned the Canadian way. When was this unrolled? Who is in charge of it? And how would you describe this way of building a roster, or at least the buy-in from a player's perspective, as compared to maybe what it was 20 years ago?
One of the neat things that Scott Salmond and you know, our predecessing president Bob Nicholson did is they formed a management group, and that management group is comprised of three CHL general managers, and one of those guys is Joel Bouchard, who Calgary fans might remember was a Calgary Flame. He's been really instrumental in a lot of ideas and idea building with all of our programs, but him, along with Scott Salmond, Sean Bullock, who runs our under 17 program here in the office, talked about what's the message that we can give our players that is, you know, the way that we play, and we thought of the Canadian way. And I think over the last more so 6 to 7 months, especially with the success that we had at the Olympics, is detailing some of those things, and that's execution, that's work ethic, that's competitiveness. And it's not as much a forecheck or a breakout or those types of things. It's more of those little things that it takes, blocking shots, being a team player, being a good person on and off the ice. And all those things kind of form the Canadian way, and yet it's a little bit different for everyone. And that was a neat message that Tom Rennie brought to our opening night talk with these players, is that the Canadian way means a little bit different to everyone. So form that yourself and put those ideas together yourself and form your own Canadian way. So it's really been a powerful message from us. It's an open-ended message, and yet we do have some specifics that are non-negotiables when you do play for Canada.
Has it changed the way that we build rosters? I can't help but think back to Nagano in 98, where at the Olympics, our fourth line really was, seemed like a collection of very good bottom six forwards. And then I look at Sochi, and your fourth line had, you know, Matt Duchene, Marty St. Louis. These are top line guys. Is that a philosophical change that Hockey Canada made, or was that just a lack of depth back in 98?
I think with the way this Olympic team performed, we have to respect how much skill, how much depth we have in our country. And when you're taking the energy grind line, when you're taking checking players and putting them in checking roles, you're cutting that depth in half. The international hockey landscape is changing. Other countries are getting better. We've got not only to keep up with them, but we've got to try and stay a step ahead of them. And when we don't take our best skilled guys and our most talented players to an event, we're playing right into their hand. And what we have to do is we have to respect that the coaches who coach our teams and the players who come in and play on our teams are going to play a Canadian style anyway. They're going to play a Canadian way. But using that depth that we have of talent, using our skill to our advantage, putting a more balanced roster of skill together as opposed to your typical top two lines of being skilled guys, your third line of maybe a two-way line, and your fourth line being a defensive line. Let's beat them with our skill and our talents because we still have that in Canada, and we don't want to forget that.
Is the mystique of a physical, intimidating Canadian team in international play gone? I think there's a lot of countries that aren't as scared of our nation as maybe they were 10 years ago. Is that fair to say or not?
I think that's fair to say. I still think we can wear teams down. I feel that when we play a Canadian way with our work ethic, with our intensity, I still think that we can... and maybe not intimidate teams and countries the way that we have in the past, but we can still get to them and keep on the fire, keep pushing, keep rolling, and keep going after them. And yet, the day of the huge hit, 2 minutes into the game, and the other team on the bench sitting back and going, oh my gosh, we don't want to face this, that is over. That was 10, 15, 20 years ago. The other countries are better. Everybody's playing a more... we'll call it Canadian style of hockey, and yet we still feel that as the leaders in the game, we want to bring a blend of our talent with our work ethic, with our compete, with our intensity.
How excited are you about the under-20 group that you've got this year? I know just from a Calgary perspective, selfishly, we had Morgan Klimchuk on the air yesterday. There's a lot of other guys that are from here, Josh Morrissey, amongst others, that maybe have a good chance. And maybe I'm wrong on some of the names and eligibilities, but is this looking like a good crop for U-20, or do you really have to wait and see how the dust settles in terms of NHL rosters?
Well, you bang on the names. We're excited about this group, the 95-borns. It was a real strong draft from an NHL standpoint. It was a real strong international year for us with our 95-born group, who are the 19-year-olds this year. They won a gold medal with the under-18 World Championships, so they've won. They know how to win. We're excited about it, and yet it's really hard to say because you never know what's going to happen with the National Hockey League, with their influence, who you're going to have available. But this summer is a chance for our coaching staff, led by Ben Grew of the Gatineau Olympique and the Quebec League, to really set a message to our players of what it's going to take to win. And our whole message there has been the world-class player. These players are good players where they play. They're excellent players in the CHL or wherever it is that they're currently playing. However, to win for Canada at the international level, these players have to be world-class. So that's the message. That's everything that's going to be drawn out for these players here this summer. And then as we get into the season, we just see where we're at. And if we tap into our depth, once again, that's one of our strong points in the country. And if we have to do that, I think we're comfortable with doing that.
It's going to be a huge World Juniors. It's the Toronto and Montreal co-hosting the event. We're talking about the two biggest hockey markets in the country, arguably on planet Earth. How big will the pressure and spotlight be with Toronto-Montreal this winter?
Well, I think the spotlight will be huge. A lot of people call it pressure. We call it a challenge. And yet our players are really well ready for this, well prepared. And that's all part of what we're going to do this summer, is just prepare the players for what's going to be coming, especially a guy like Connor McDavid, who has a lot of hype and a lot of notoriety already. And yet these guys are almost professionals from an NHL standpoint. From our standpoint, they're pros already. And we think that they'll be well prepared for dealing with anything that comes. And the great part about Hockey Canada, led now by Tom Rennie and Scott Salmon on the hockey standpoint, is that all we do is you just want the players to play hockey. And we try and prepare them with all the preparation that's needed, and at the end of the day, just go on the ice and perform.
Ryan, one final one before we get you off to the rink, I'm sure, in a busy few days here with your under-17, under-18. What kind of conversations would happen if you've got a player in the NHL that's eligible to be playing in the under-20s, maybe their ice time is dwindling, they've plateaued or hit a rut mid-season in that long first pro campaign, as Hockey Canada, would you call a general manager? What sort of dialogue is there between NHL general managers and Hockey Canada about letting a kid go to this tournament and maybe breaking up the season or putting them in a high-pressure, must-win situation versus maybe a monotonous, continuous losing season in the NHL?
Yeah, that's a real good question, and we try and be proactive. Again, Scott Salmon, Tom Rennie, with their NHL contacts, are always reaching out to the NHL teams, just assuring them that the opportunity is there. We understand that they have other interests, and their interests are for their team and their player. However, from our standpoint, we always let them know that the opportunity is there and that the players want it. And, you know, what we can provide from a development standpoint for that player is obviously very different, especially if they haven't been a part of it before. So those conversations are always ongoing once training camp starts. And yet you don't want to get too excited probably until November. And even then, when you get into December, so many things can happen with NHL teams, with injuries and, you know, how a team is playing, for example, that, you know, you can get excited about it in September when, you know, player X ends up staying in the National Hockey League. But really until early December, you have no idea how things are going to play out.
Ryan, pleasure checking in with you this morning. Great hearing your speech there at the coaches' conference a couple of weekends ago in Vancouver. Keep up the great work, and we'll have to stay in touch as some of these events that come up in the fall get closer to the radar here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
All right. That's Ryan Jankowski, head scout of Hockey Canada, running that program of excellence. U17s getting changed. U18 already a great track record of success there. If you want to see the stars of tomorrow today, you can head to the Mark and McPhail Center. Today, tomorrow, Sunday, after an off day Saturday, Monday and Tuesday, it'll be U17 and U18 action. All kids under 12 are free. It's $10 a person. Otherwise, that gets you access to both rinks all day. And Friday. I keep thinking it's Thursday today. Friday, August 1st, if you bring a piece of new or gently used hockey equipment, you'll get free admission, all to watch the best our nation has in young talent just years away from making an impact at the NHL level. We'll pause. We'll come back with your 9 o'clock hour, a conversation with Jordan Henry about the KHL. And next, James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail talking about all things Leafs and maybe what we can expect as Calgary Flames fans and broadcasters covering the team regarding Mason Raymond for the next three seasons. It is Sportsnet 960, The Fan.